Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today on Living Mythology, I'm proud to bring you mages, sages, and seers with Frater Serpentis Satori. Greetings and welcome, Satori. How are you?
All right.
Glad to hear it. Today's a pretty exciting day. I'm on the computer a lot. I gave a talk at Witches Fest USA 2022. Now we're speaking, and I'm giving another talk later this afternoon, and then we have our UFO panel. So today is a day filled with communication.
That's always good.
It is always good. You had wanted to continue our discussion on folk magic. And as I love both folklore and the magical tradition, I'm really interested in hearing what you have to share.
Well, I picked up New World Witchery a month ago. But, I mean, I guess this begins with the article I sent you almost 2 months ago now about the Supreme Court case that creates a thousand witches. Talking about how witchcraft is an attempt to regain empowerment in the patriarchy. And as religious zealots of the other type try to take control of women and their bodies, the backlash invariably leads to witchcraft.
No, that's very
which is a friend of mine.
And I can see that.
Well, it's also part of, in the United States, two most predominant stereotypes of witches are either Irish or voodoo, and both of which are oppressed people.
That's a very good point, and one that I would like to address very much through podcasts. We've had a conversation about starting a dialogue about theurgy and Wicca, or theurgy and witchcraft. And we have a list of people who are interested in participating in that discussion. And of course, you're on that list. How would you suggest we proceed opening up this topic? Because it promises to be very good.
That's a very, very large area. And part of what that book did that I found very interesting is, well, one of the things that caught me in the very beginning is he actually separates out the Latin traditions of Santeria and Bruja from Vodun, Hoodoo, and Southern Conjure.
Okay.
Yeah, see, on the outside, that doesn't make any sense to the rest of you, but as someone who worked at Reverend Zombies, the fact that he is well-versed enough to separate those out, because they're drawing from similar information, it just is that Hoodoo is more plug-and-play, because Hoodoo has always been more mercantile. Hoodoo has always been more about the gree-gree man hooking you up with a gree-gree or blue balls or candles or whatever, whereas the more Latin traditions have always been more community-based. And even though there are a lot of overlap, a lot of the Puerto Rican and Mexican traditions are more based on things you can get at the grocery store, as opposed to having to go to a botanica and get, like, the court case candle and the court case incense and the court case oil. So the fact that he was able to split those up, and the fact that Southern Conjure usually is a step away from snake handling Christianity. It tends to be the witchy part of snake handling. Or at least that's how my friend defined it, who used to work at at the Voodoo Shop, and she is the place where Irish witchcraft overlaps with voodoo because she worked at Marie Laveau's. So when I sent her that piece, we got into the conversation, and I reminded her that almost everyone I consider to be a real witch starts the conversation about witchcraft comes from oppression. What it, and you can even make that argument about Roman curse tablets too. We can say this whole witchcraft comes from oppression thing does go all the way back to ancient Athens, because what they were doing in Egypt isn't exactly witchcraft. That's not witchcraft exactly. But when you get into the Western world, witchcraft may go all the way back to Medea, may go all the way back to how women were treated in Athens.
For folks,
that might be true.
For folks who don't know the difference between witchcraft and Wicca, can you give a basic definition?
Wiccans believe in harm none, and Wicca was created in the 40s by Joel Gardner and Aleister Crowley. Witchcraft is much older and much darker. Wiccans very much are the harm none, peace and love, super vanilla of the world of magic. Part of where they get into it with witches is witches, especially in the Irish and voodoo traditions that do come from so much oppression, are very comfortable with using justice magic and using magic to get the people who you can't call the police on.
Now, given that definition that magic arises from powerlessness, how can it be used to empower rather than just giving the feeling of empowerment?
Lifelong practice.
Okay.
Making it part of your daily life rather than just burning black man candles when you want to curse somebody. But that tends to be the difference between the professional level practitioner and the person who only uses it when they need it.
Now, one of the things I see from my studies is that the law of attraction, which is not really a law, but anyway, it's called the law of attraction, which was brought into the public eye with the New Thought movement here in America at some point, and since become a thing in and of itself. Once you understand the logic behind doing certain things, you begin to notice that people are doing it to a much greater extent than you would have thought just by reading the material and experimenting with it. And that the types of guidelines that are given for the law of attraction, you can see them play out on even the highest levels of society. They're basically words, words create reality, and now we call it controlling
right.
the narrative. But it's basically a magical principle. You're laying a glomer on wide segments of the population. We see this play out again in our news. That tends to create the perception of power up until the point where you get into the truly really powerful who are doing it, and then it's how this power is applied, how it's created, and how it's maintained. So would the empowerment of witchcraft born of oppression fall under the same principle? The basic principles of magic are the same or are nearly universal, and then in application and in practice and mastery, they become a whole new toolkit to be used on an entirely different level.
Well, the New Thought stuff is all in your head. It's all visualization and affirmation and tools of that nature that are ultimately of Indian origin. Or Egyptian, and aren't as grounded in the physical plane as the craft of witchcraft.
Okay.
That all of those things are useful to help you deprogram yourself from the oppression and the social conditioning, but they might not be able to break through and get you what you want.
I don't know, because I've had a lot of success with, I guess you call it the more American forms of magic, and certainly the, you know, positive thinking and the law of attraction, you know, falls under like New World magic, as does the I Am movement and the New Age, even though they were based on beliefs and practices from elsewhere. They've taken a very unique and distinct force in the American imagination and in the American gestalt, I guess. And I found that even in and of themselves, if you know what you're doing with them, they produce remarkable results.
They can, but on a lot of levels, they're there to be the backbone of practice, not to be the practice itself. They're there to teach you meditation and affirmation and how to overcome those negative thoughts, because a lot of people that think they're cursed aren't really cursed. They're just negative.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're attracting negativity. They're not really cursed.
Right. I remember when
right.
I was in services early on in the 1980s, I worked with a Haitian a population, mostly in terms of home attending, because the qualifications for the jobs were open to you know, a lot of people, including Haitian immigrants, and it paid relatively better than doing certain other types of food, like in the hospitality industry, for instance, or in fast food or so forth. And I remember that a home attendant got very upset that I removed her from a particular case. And I removed her from the case because the family had lodged some complaints, and it was better for her if I removed her for the case. And I spoke to her about it, but she didn't buy that. And I started hearing from other home attendants as she started doing magic against me. And now at that particular point in my life, because again, this is 1980s, even though I grew up with folk magic of a Greek kind mostly, I was familiar enough with it to know that nothing could happen to me if I didn't believe that anything would happen to me. So I started wearing reflective eye jewelry. And back then you get some really cool looking rings that were made from glass eyes. And, you know, there was a lot of jewelry back then that you can't find really now. So anyway, I said nothing, but I wore these rings, and she saw the rings, and the other people who were warning me magic saw the rings. And she started to freak out because she believed that whatever work she was doing was reflecting on her threefold or ninefold, or I don't remember the exact formula that voodoo was taking at the time, of the types of things that she was doing, the cursing. But she stopped. But if I believed that something could happen or would happen to me, then something, chances are, like you're saying, would happen to me, because I wouldn't really be cursed. It'd be the product of my own negative obsessive thoughts.
I mean, my Irish witch friend at one point joked that all curse magic is placebo magic.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting.
Because everyone was so used. Well, everyone was so used to thinking that she was using curse magic all the time that at a certain point it just became a joke between the two of us. Because she would just like point at someone and move her lips, and they would think they were cursed. And then they would start to be cursed.
Right.
And she and I would know that she didn't really do anything.
Right.
And some of those curses turned out to be pretty nasty. It was just the nature of, because we worked at the voodoo shops and we were who we were, people believed it.
Right.
And so some of those people who had bad karma coming had bad things happen. Even though in practice, she didn't make a doll. She didn't do anything except the guy thought she did.
And that's the power of suggestion, I guess, for lack of a better term.
I said earlier that I think all magic and all medicine is placebo anyway, but I'm not really sure that there is a real difference between the placebo effect and magic, except you accept that such and such a talisman is going to attract love or money or luck because you're told it does. And so it does in the same way that an affirmation does. Right.
That's a very good point. And I know that those types of things can be powerful if you allow them to become powerful. And they could have either a positive or a negative effect on you, depending on what you buy into, what belief system you buy into.
But that's also the boundary of, like, how much of this is real and how much a non-believer can be affected by something they don't believe in.
Well, I found that the American forms of magic are very effective because of your focus. So I'll give an example, a concrete example. I decided one day that I wanted a television show and that the television show would star me doing a bunch of things that I wanted to do. It was a social commentary show primarily. So I had no idea how to do that. This was before the internet was as prevalent as it is now. So, I have to research and talk to people and, again, look at things online when I have the opportunity to. But I did what I always do when I'm at that point where I decide I want to do something and I don't know how. I got a notebook and I jotted down ideas, like if I had a show, what would it be called? What would it be about? Who would I have on the show regularly? Who would be on as a guest? What would we talk about? What is the message of the show and so forth. And after a year and a half, the circumstances lined up where I was able to get a TV show. And it was my show, and I was able to do all those things that I thought about for a year and a half. And I even had a lot of the same people on it, both celebrities and interesting people who weren't at the time celebrities. And what I concluded about being like really conscious of what I was doing is that opportunities come our way all the time. And if you're focused on finding particular types of opportunities, when they pop up, you're more likely to say yes than if you don't focus your attention. So you could say yes to those opportunities when they turn up. And my yes came when I wrote an article on UFOs and people who are incarnate UFO aliens. So I got less response to that than anything I'd ever written or published. There was no response to it at all. Nobody seemed to care about the topic. And that was very surprising. But one person contacted me, and that person wanted me to talk on a television show. So I agreed, of course, because that takes me a step closer to where I wanted to go. And then when I got to be the guest on TV, she was in a panic. Her regular co-host had just been scarfed up by a bigger national show. So she asked if I was able to co-host a TV show. So she never asked me if I'd done it before, because then I would have said, no, I've never done it before. It was my first time on TV other than being asked a man in the street type of question, which I think everybody's been on that type of thing at one point or another. So I accepted. She asked me if I could do it, and I had faith in myself that I could do it if somebody showed me what to do a couple of times. So anyway, that led to appearances on her show as a co-host when she needed one, as a guest host when she had things to do. As a co-host sometimes when we had guests in a particular area of expertise that I had more knowledge than she did. And I also left myself open to being a guest on everybody else's shows that was there. So before you know it, anytime anybody needed somebody, if I wasn't doing anything else for survival or, seeing loved ones or whatever, I just say yes. That became what I did that particular day. So I logged in all those hours. And after another year and a half, no, it wasn't a year and a half, it was a year and a half total. Toward the end of the year and a half, I was called in by the station managers, and they said that they liked my appearances on all these shows. How would I like to have a show of my own? And they asked me what type of show would I have if they gave me a show. And because I've been thinking about this for a year and a half and writing everything down in a notebook, I was able to tell them exactly what I would do. And they loved it, and ergo, my show was born. So whether you choose to believe that there was magic involved or no magic involved or it was the law of attraction, if you cut everything with an Occam's razor, it's just the fact that I wanted a particular set of circumstances, and then I just said yes to anything that would bring me closer. And I spent time not worrying about how I was going to do it, although I did research that, but what I would do if I had the opportunity. So that was like with the placebo effect being at the core of a lot of magic. I believe also saying yes to opportunities, because it's easy to say no when an opportunity passes you by.
Well, that's also in those of us who use circuit the voodoo shops in New Orleans, the most popular thing after the $5 talisman is road opener. And road opener is liquid opportunity. But again, if it's just a placebo effect, you're just more open to saying yes,
mm-hmm.
because you're paying attention because you're using road opener.
Right. Right.
And it would be the most popular thing. It would be the most popular thing because my Irish witch friend actually joked that it was liquid plumber for reality.
That's a good way of saying it.
That's her particular opinion on these things, which I always find amusing because I'm like, well,
okay. Are you there, Satori? We seem to have been disconnected. I will play a song until we're able to be reconnected. Let's see what we shall play. If You Can Dream, that's an appropriate song, and I happen to love the song. So here we go.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky, but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream till it's real. If you can dream, then you can be bound by love and yet be free, but only if you can dream. When love and trust are deep and fair, There is nothing your heart won't dare, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream. Till it's real. Dream till it's real. Dream till it's real.
That was one of my favorite songs, If You Can Dream, by Virginia Ackley. And now back to Serpenta Satori. Greetings, Satori.
Hello.
So we were talking about placebo effects of certain types of magic, and we were talking about the road opener. And that sounds very fascinating. I usually, in my visualizations, I open a door to certain things that I want to enter my life. And then I see things as they would be if the door was open. And I try to reinforce that as much as possible.
Well, if you're a middle-level person in the world of magic in a city like New Orleans, you're a doctor, like mm-hmm. Dr. John. You give out remedies to help people with their lives. And the two most common remedies, unless you have a stack of gree-gree laying around, tend to be whatever your preferred helpful talisman is, which we used to call the $5 talisman, because all of us who worked at the shop had it. Well, you have all of those in the Key of Solomon. You have all of there are about 40 common talismans.
Okay.
And whichever one is the one you think people need to be using more becomes the one you recommend to help. And the second most common thing is, you're just blocking yourself, so you need road opener. And at the voodoo shops in New Orleans, that was one of the best-selling products anyway. So those of us that work there got used to, there's no need for me to teach you anything complicated if I just give you some road opener, which is how it becomes the liquid plumber of reality. Because you get used to, no, my road opener is effective, but you have to use the whole bottle and you can't stop.
Right.
And do not use it as a hand wash. Do not wash your hands with it. Wash your whole body. No. I don't know the story about don't use it as a hand wash. But that became one of our inside jokes among those of us who used to work there. Because I guess someone at some point did that and I'm not sure what happened.
Reinforcing the belief in road opener happened.
Well, it's that, what was the interesting thing about the Of Blood and Bones book, having a four-ingredient road opener, that when all of us saw that, because a lot of ours are extensive and
mm-hmm.
take time and money to put in, and to see a version of that spell that had four ingredients and took about 24 hours was very, very strange to the people who used to work at Marie Laveau's, and led to much, much, much conversation.
Well, I can see if you go looking at things in terms of a placebo effect, I can see how the longer preparation and the more complex ritual and a list of ingredients would be helpful.
It's called a cook. It's called a cook because you're cooking your spell.
Right.
In the same way that a spell book in New Orleans is also called a cookbook. You're just not cooking food. And when people live with someone like me, every once in a while there are things like sriracha that they see me buy. And I'm like, no, that's not for the kitchen. Go watch Doom Patrol. That's not for the kitchen. Well, because even the joke about Sriracha got worked into Doom Patrol, and now all of us are like, well, see, that's not a secret now. Now people wonder what's up with them. Like, well, now it's in Doom Patrol. Now whenever someone asks what that's about, like, Sriracha and your $5 talisman, protection from evil. Check it out.
Well, so
but yeah, I mean, a more extensive allows you to develop more flavors and makes for more elaborate results because you're putting more ingredients in and more of your personal energy. So if your road opener wash, for instance, takes 28 entire days to make, that's a very extensive road opener oil.
Right.
And has a market value that would reflect that because of all the ingredients and all the time required, plus the fact that most of us who used to work at Marie Laveau's and Reverend Zombies don't make a lot at a time because we really don't like that. I don't even like carrying mine on the bus. Like, I could spill it. I don't know what'll happen if someone steps in it.
You'll have something to warn people about later on.
No, but it's the same way with anything that you just don't want to carry it when it's locked and loaded.
Right.
And even though I don't make a lot of road opener anymore, I only tend to do it when I have a friend who's looking for something specific. Although in the immediate aftermath of COVID, we all dove into pumping out large, large batches of road opener in the immediate aftermath because we realized that everybody was job hunting and the easiest thing we could mass produce and give everyone we knew was road opener. And then that's over with. Then you get a then we do a tarot reading and we give you your road opener. We send you on your merry way and you find whatever job you're supposed to find. I've done my part as a magician. You've used the road opener oil, so you now have the experience of what my road opener oil does when I make it. No, go
and
ahead.
This could be applied to any mythic system the one ascribes to. For instance, in the Olympian tradition, it would be Hermes normally, although there are other deities like Hecate and Hercules who have much to do with the roads and crossroads and things like that. But I guess you could use those deities to further reinforce your belief that the road opener would work.
Yeah, or you could just use a sacred oil consecrated to one of them, which is probably where this all started anyway.
In Greece, I had the experience of being treated with magic. Speaking to quite a few magicians, and there's two ancestors of mine, one of which I could have met, that's another story for another day, but who made it into the folklore of magicians in Greece. And I know through them and through the magic that was done on me when I was sick, that their ingredients were pretty simple too. And when I received treatment, it turned out here, when I came back here, they diagnosed it as pneumonia and treated it like pneumonia. But in Greece, I got a magical interpretation. I got a medical interpretation. But the magical one worked better than the medical one while I was there. And the ingredients seemed to be a charcoal briquette, some cloves, and a knowledge of arithmetic, if I could make out what was being chanted while the cloves were burning. And the effect was whenever things reached a certain pitch in the chant, the cloves would explode on the incense burner. So I didn't quite get what was being done, but the ingredients were fairly simple. There were ingredients.
It was drying the illness out because at some earlier point, they probably used bones.
Uh-huh.
At some earlier point, that probably was very, very ancient sympathetic magic that was using throughout the illness and explode when they take the evil away.
the evil eye is very much a part of modern Greek folk magic. And I remember when I was younger, because here I was Greek, and when I went there, I was American. So it was one of these weird things with being bicultural. But when I would explain in Greece that in America they didn't believe in the evil eye, the answer was always, well, Americans are stupid and they're spiritually blind, because anybody can tell you the evil eye is a real thing. And in Greece at the time, they believed in it very powerfully. So the gaze and what, like, gestures with the fingers, as you explained earlier, honest admiration, jealousy, envy, all those things could really mess up a person's life. And they had the feel of...
I mean, that was my coworker's joke about fake curse magic.
Uh-huh.
That's... In Europe, that would be the evil eye. But because we were in New Orleans and we worked at the voodoo shops, people thought it worked.
Right. And they had in Greece.
And the results were quite different if she actually did something.
Mm-hmm.
Results were much more specific if she actually did it.
There was a charm I remember they had at the time. But I don't see this type of charm anymore, but it was a triangle of cloth. And it was sewn together with, like, little beads. And on it, there was a symbol of an eye. And inside, there was supposed to be Christian relics, like a splinter from the true cross or something like that was usually said to have been inside the thing. They were called philakta, protectors. And just about everybody you saw in Greece, especially babies, had one pinned to their T-shirt. Or upper garment, you know, to protect them from evil.
Right, because that's protection, that's getting rid of negativity, which is the whole point of almost all protection charms.
Very interesting. I'm going to contemplate that and try to reframe a lot of my current beliefs to see how these fit into the picture. So thank you. You might have drastically altered how I view certain things.
Well, that's the weird. I mean, when I started at the voodoo shop, I was a very high-level hermetic magician with a mostly hermetic background, and most of my personal practice was either angelology or Enochian.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a fair understanding of folk magic, all of the witches I've associated with it to that point in my life. But to go from super high magic as what I do for myself to selling Grigri and road opener.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other hermetics still don't understand that about me. Like, but, I'm like, well, sometimes the low magic is faster. And with the war in Ukraine, I don't see Michael right now. I don't want to call him right now. I don't want to see what he's doing. He's busy. This is easier. And this is easier to teach people. And then you get into, like, the places – no, then you get into all that places where they interweave when people start combining angelology and psalms and that level of folk magic that was originally Jewish folk magic that both leads to hermeticism and Southern conjure. It's the grandmother of both, even though those traditions would not realize that.
It's the same with the neo-theosophies, the theosophies of today, which don't call themselves theosophy anymore, but they're essentially theosophy. A lot of them have roots that would be very surprising to them if they were aware of the roots.
Well, I mean, back in New Orleans at the time, when I started doing voodoo ceremonies, my Irish witch friend thought it was just odd that I was there, but the oldest person in the room just said I was just super retro. that in the 20s, it wouldn't have been weird for the Rosicrucians and Hermetics to be doing stuff for Shango and Allegra. That was normal in New Orleans in the 20s and 30s, just that 60 years later, the divide had become the divide because of whatever happened in the 70s. And there wasn't very much communication between those communities anymore.
Well, I found that to be, again, very, very interesting and very true. There was a lot more, like, for instance, now a lot of things are seen as cultural appropriation. And I can see that and sympathize with it to some extent in that my own journey through modern Greek paganism often exposed me to people who weren't Greek, who and again the Greek part of it.
But a lot of that has to do with all of the gatekeeping going on in the world right now.
Uh-huh.
That even on a list I'm on YouTube, I was told voodoo is closed. Me. And I'm like, I used to work at Reverend Zombies. Voodoo is not closed.
No,
go to your Puerto Rican neighborhood.
The Olympian system is an open to anybody in Western civilization. In fact, that's how Western civilization spread. So it's not a closed system, but there are many who would make it a closed system. And where they draw those lines is cherry-picked from things that were done in antiquity that we wouldn't do anymore now, for the most part. And it becomes a very random thing what they pick and choose, and then they defend it.
Well, that's the thing with all gatekeeping. All gatekeeping is a random thing between what's available on YouTube and what's available on Amazon. I'm not sure anything is secret anymore.
I found that what is secret, like what I haven't come across, is how certain things like work. Like, for instance, you're one of the few people I've met who understands the power of popular culture. That's slowly coming into people's awareness because people have been citing it more. Also, sorcery on a very high level was something that was invisible until now. And now people are talking about controlling narratives and alternate realities because of controlled narratives. That was something that, you know, you really needed to have done a lot before you got that. And now it's become common knowledge. So whatever is secret is becoming, as you're pointing out, the less secret. But in terms of insights as to how certain communication systems work with the invisible, a lot of those still seem to be invisible, which I consider a good thing.
Well, a lot of those used to need to have a teacher to explain entities like Hecate and Allegra.
Mm-hmm.
Because messing with them, if you don't know what you're doing, probably is bad. But that's also the thing about treating magic like it's a salad bar. Because that's what I think cultural appropriation truly is this whole eclectic salad bar mentality towards spirituality. That you can't just tape Hinduism to voodoo. That's impossible because voodoo's all about blood magic. There's no way it about Hindu would go anywhere near a Haitian ritual, especially considering you have to kill an animal to come in the door.
A lot of
and that's
people,
just the most glaring example.
I remember when I first learned about the Afro-Caribbean religions, and I've shared that story with the Shango necklace, which I didn't know was a Shango necklace, and how that opened the door to my understanding the strange Catholicism of my cousins and so forth. I remember once I became aware of things and understood them a little bit better, I had students who were Afro-Caribbean when I was teaching in a community college, and I would always be able to tell because of the jewelry they wore, the beads and things, who they had initiations
right.
with and so forth. So initially they would deny it, just say, no, it's just a decorative cultural thing. And then later on when they grew up.
I just like cowrie shells.
They admitted it. A lot of them had problems with the blood part of the magic, so they were compromised. Like they would buy meat from butchers or from supermarkets and pour the blood residue that's in the plastic packaging on top of their legwa heads and things like that. So there's always, when you have cultures collide, this desire to prefer the ways of one culture or the other, or try to mix them together so it causes less problems. I remember when I lived in Astoria, which was at the time when I lived there, a very Greek area in New York City, the Easter time, sacrificing the Paschal lamb wound a lot of traditional Greek families who at other times seemed to be normally acculturated into getting in trouble with animal protection agencies and so forth, who didn't understand that the lamb was treated well because it's a sacrifice. This is Easter with the death and blood resurrection. And they would eat the lamb. They wouldn't let any of it go to waste. It would all be used to feed everybody. And it was time of coming together, and it was a reflection of the Christian myth. But still, they'd get arrested, they'd get fined, the lambs would get taken away because it didn't fit in with the surrounding culture's ideas of what people should do with lambs, who they've been treating as pets in their backyard.
Well, in the same way, a lot of my friends who are Roman pagans in modern America, we actually have to eat our Lupercalia goat from an Indian restaurant.
I can see that.
We end up doing tandoori goat on Lupercalia, and that's really weird. But a good Indian restaurant knows how to cook goat, and a lot of Greek and Lebanese restaurants don't just do shawarma in America. You can't really get a goat from a Greek restaurant in America much. So you end up doing a tandoori goat for Lupercalia, and that's just how we have to deal with it in America, because we still get our goat bones. All of that works the way that works. It's also the result of the weird melting pot America is. But that's what I always think cultural appropriation is. It's not that Allegra only wants to work with people of African descent. There's a reason you're buying Allegra head. You're supposed to be given it. Because you're supposed to connect to the relationship with the person who gave it to you. And so just going on Etsy and buying an Allegra head probably isn't a good idea if you haven't had one before.
That's a whole other topic, and one we'll pursue another day.
Yes, that's for another time, but that's what I think cultural appropriation is when you try to, in the same way that a lot of Norse paganism, people treat like that is a completely white people thing.
Right.
And there are some people within the Norse community that want to keep it that way.
Yes, there are. That has become more and more prevalent in my investigations. I remember when that started, at least in the current round, World War II was going on and before, during the Volkisch movement. And I remember when it started happening here as well.
Yeah, and that's where that boundary is. The question is, where is that boundary for people that aren't crazy?
In the talk that I had with Witches Fest USA 2022, the main focus was on Olympian shamanism, like a basic introduction to the concept. And also, I spent a lot of time talking about relationships with divine powers. And how, again, being Greek, it came easy because in Greek parochial school and through the culture, I learned that we were all divine. You're descended from gods.
Right.
Even though nobody believed in the gods anymore, we descended from them. And we descended from kings and heroes and all sorts of things like that. And so it puts you in the divine realm. And if you decided to pursue more ancient forms of magic or worship or understanding the world, you know, whatever road you took, the road would take you there. And the road you took wasn't as important as taking the road. So the way I've always described it is, let's say your goal is to get to 59th Street in Manhattan. Depending on how close you are to 59th Street in Manhattan, you have a number of choices. So let's say you live near, not that ridiculous amount of time away where you'd have to take a railroad or a plane or a boat to get to 59th Street. If you lived in the area and you want to go to 59th Street, you could walk if you had no money, or if you liked walking, you could ask a friend to give you a lift. You can take a cab. If money isn't as much of an object, then, you know, you don't have the vehicle. In, you know, driving yourself, you can also take a bus or a series of buses to get to 59th Street. Eventually, you would attain your goal. And the different ways had pluses and minuses monetarily and also in terms of time and how likely were you to get derailed from reaching your goal. But they're all approaches to get to 59th Street. And where we seem to get hung up, not only in Western culture, but in other cultures as well, is we fight about the road we're taking. And very few people actually take the time to follow the road to 59th Street. But it's like, oh, I'm on the railroad path. You know, the railroad path is superior, you know, because it reaches a wider number of people, takes them there quicker and safer. No, 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 I am on the airplane route. Ah, but the airplane route, you need to take a cab afterwards or whatever. I'm making it deliberately ridiculous. But we spend way too much time as spiritual travelers fighting over the roads run and getting prestige from whatever prestige the road happens to have.
Well, but that's just spiritual pride. And as someone who grew up in Greater Cleveland and then moved to New Orleans, both of those cultures are so mixed together with so many kinds of magic and paganism and practice that at a certain point you do end up at that, like, Hellenistic, okay, in my country he's called Hermes, in your country he's called Alegua.
Right.
You end up there because it's not that the Santero is going to be irrelevant as a child of Hecate. It's that he wouldn't know Hecate if he saw her. Because because Hecate is so idiomatically Greek. She's one of those goddesses that doesn't really translate. And I think we get hung up on that because Christians are always doing that to us. Christians are always telling us that we're wrong. And I don't quite come from the Jungian perspective on that, but I think that the answer is Imago Dei, that we work with the aspect of God that we work with, that we're comfortable with. And people that want to play my God can beat up your God.
And many do.
As we used to say. But that's exactly what it is. It's my dad can beat up your dad, but my dad is Zeus and your dad is Yahweh. Exactly what it is. It's the same thing. We just need to understand that that's sandbox mentality.
Mm-hmm.
They just aren't out of the sandbox yet. They're not even in seventh grade. They're still in the sandbox. These people are not spiritually advanced enough to really help the gods in the world because they're still arguing about, like, your God is false. And because on a deeper level as a polytheist, I do agree with the Hindus about, I do think all gods are false and are thought forms for our benefit. Because we can't wrap our heads around infinite. And because since we are all God, we seek the God who is either most like us or most helpful to. Well, that's Santeria. That's all of the religions that make us children of gods.
Right.
And the God you're a child of isn't necessarily the one who you are most like. Sometimes it's the one who has the most for you to do.
And that comes through in even things like fantasy role playing, which is a really interesting topic in and of itself. The use of active imagination to perform like certain types of operations that are in stories. But that's a topic for another day. But usually people create characters that are idealized self or shadow. And then
right.
The third category is they want to experiment with the rules. So idealized self, like for instance, when I rarely play. I was always the DM when playing, but the rare chances I got to play, I was always like a Herculean or barbaric character, because that's my idealized self. Other people would become like assassins or thieves. That was their shadow. Those are things that they couldn't do in life that they wanted to do, but they were constrained, so they played them out in the fantasy. And then some people just want to see.
Or like the game master that made me play Vision.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm such a Dionysus personality type, it amused him to make me be Vision, to watch me be Philosopher King Marvel Superman, to be able to be all of the weird things Vision is in that weird game, because it amused him to see how I was going to handle it.
And I wish we had longer than like 2.5 minutes, because this is of special interest. I've been looking at this a lot lately. I still run games, recreationally, and basically as guided visualizations, almost. So that is something that we have, and I can speak endless hours about. You still want people to contact you through me if they seek contact? Is that correct?
Yeah, for now, because I'm trying to do some work for the organization itself and try to work on workbooks and stuff for how we're setting things up in the near future.
Understood. I've invited you. Do you want to be part of the Wicca Theurgy conversations?
If I can work it with my schedule, because I have a weird schedule because of all my situations.
Okay. I was thinking of having the individual episodes as we have it now. So everybody who's getting involved has a Mages, Sages, and Seers platform, either as a regular or as a guest. The other one would be on a panel. I'm thinking of using Zoom. Is Zoom something that's
acceptable? I might have to learn how to use it.
Okay. I can walk you through the simple stuff. It's free and it's pretty convenient to use. If you don't want your picture shown, it shows your telephone number, but I'm sure you can put another graphic on your phone to prevent that. That's beyond today's show. Thank you very much, Satori. It's always a pleasure and always stimulating speaking with you. I look forward to future adventures, and I'm grateful for all old adventures. Thanks again, my friend.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Be well. Bye-bye. And thanks to everybody who joined us today, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called and you're patiently waiting in our queue, or whether you'll check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Take care.